Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 3.
Len, you're talking about the two landmines that fell, and they both exploded, one of them fairly close to you.
Yes, we were in Geraldine. We were driving along Geraldine Road, or at least I'd turned into Geraldine Road because I thought I'd miss them. But it was coming very close, and I managed to get to the end of Geraldine. I think it was Allfarthing Lane or something like that, and turned into that just as these bombs went off. And when we saw the consequences of it, there was rubber all round us. And Kirby Green is a bit of a mad bugger. He said, "Bloody good show, Trev. We got an incident all of our own." He didn't realise how serious it was, because he went off to do what he could to help people who were in distress or calling in the neighbourhood, and I got to work on a partly demolished house that I could hear calls coming from, I spent hours, at least I can't remember how long I spent, but I got up on the rubble and was trying to shift rafters and girders and brick rubble because I could hear this voice. And and the time went by, and eventually an off-duty soldier came along, and he could see that I was exhausted and making no progress, so he said, "Well, I'll take over and see what I can do until the recovery services come along." So I went back to the car. I couldn't see Kirby Green, but he'd obviously made his own way back, and I drove back to the garage at Putney and turned the car in about an hour and a half late, because I should have been off duty at 10, but this was about 11:30, and they were, you know, shocked to see me, and said they'd already been down to my wife at Vale Crescent to ask if I'd gone back home there, and she said no, and so there was a great deal of stress everywhere, and they were sorry that they'd disturbed her, and when I got home, of course, she was completely thrilled to see that I had got, because she got back, because she thought that I'd bought it. And it was incidents like that, time and time again, happening. Have I mentioned Putney Section House? Because this had the rare occasion of being hit on two consecutive nights by bombs within a few feet of each other. One went down and hit the bottom of the east side of the building and burst into the gym, where on that occasion a number of people were injured and one person was killed. On the next night, the bomb went slightly closer and went down through the balconies of some of the rooms above, burst on the rafter, on the steel girder that was covering the gym, and this, of course, the previous night had blown holes, so the blast wasn't quite so bad, but it blew in the door of the section house canteen and killed another station sergeant on that night. And one of the other people that had received head injuries was one of my colleagues called Hugh Duncan, and he was a wireless operator. And sad to say, he was with me when I was on another call after the war, and I'll tell you that later, but he was injured then, and eventually he died in a mental home up in Edinburgh. But that's the consequence of this bombing of the section house. But how lucky I was to have been married at that time, because the bomb went right through the room that I'd been occupying, room 39 in the section house. And I was not in the section house at that time, so I escaped that tragedy. But how lucky can you be to have two bombs in two consecutive nights?
Len, could you explain to me how the service was staffed? Explain special constables and war reserves.
Well, yes. We were looking for personnel from all sorts of sources, and at that time we had the special constables that were made permanent constables. They were enlisted for full-time duty, but we also got the help of war reserves who had, they were serving just as police officers. They had some training, but they were drawn from ordinary civilian life, people who had probably been in reserved occupations up till then and realised that the urgency was more for police force than their reserved occupation, whatever it is. But they received some training. They had classes at the station before they were allowed to go out, and they had armbands and they had truncheons and they had tin hats, you know, so they were recognisable as policemen. But I can remember there were golf pros, publicans, professional people who had been in administration, people who had been boilermakers and things like that. They were drawn from all classes. They didn't have to require, they didn't have to be the height of a normal policeman or the age of a normal policeman. There were older people as well as some older, and I think some people who had been retired from the recently retired from the police force were called back to serve. So we had a motley crowd of people serving, but they all doing their job as was required of them.
And presumably officers that came up to retirement age were not allowed to retire?
No, they weren't. They had to, well, I mean, unless they were medically unfit, but they, in most cases, they continued serving until the end of the war. And
war reserves, were they, what stopped war reserves joining the armed forces?
Well, they were usually medically unfit to serve as a soldier, but not medically unfit to do ordinary patrolling and supervision of, you know, watching for lights left exposed in properties at night and things like that. If you could walk round and you could see whether a place was properly blacked out, a job could be done like that quite adequately by a person of limited physical strength and ability.
How useful did you find these specials and war reserves as a regular officer?
They were as important to us as there was no discrimination. If they needed help, we'd help them and advice or go to their help, but we relied upon them just as another a policeman. The jobs were so demanding, there was no sort of worry about whether they were qualified as a policeman or, you know, we were glad of any person that could help at that stage. And I remember an occasion about the Wimbledon Golf Club. For example, when I mentioned the trip to the golf club where the bomber had crashed, it was war reserves that went in and gathered pieces of the wreckage and gathered vital information. So they were involved in the war as much as any regular policeman, and we were glad of them. One of the tragedies was when a direct hit was made on Wandsworth Fire Station, in which were people, a lot of reserve firemen were resting, and I think the casualty list on the casualty numbers on that day ran into 40 or 50. Now, the bodies were removed to the mortuary. Many of them were removed, but because there were so many, they had to be housed, or they had to be, the bodies had to be put into temporary mortuary accommodation, and this consisted of a corrugated roof being put right along one of the walls of the cemetery, under which were benches placed, and the bodies were placed on these benches right the way along, 20 or 30 of these bodies, so that relatives and people could come along and try and identify them before they were buried. We had a communal pit to put them all in with quicklime. And because of shortage of mortuary keepers, they were busier than anyone, policemen had to carry out mortuary observation duties. And I remember on one occasion I had to go up to this Kingston Vale cemetery one night and was given a broomstick and a torch, and I had to patrol along these bodies, first of all to keep the rats off them and not the rats, and secondly, if anyone came along, to let them go along and see if they could recognise any of these bodies before we disposed of them into the pit. And I spent, I spent all night long on this, and there's not another person came close to me, and I just spent the whole night there. And talk about being stressed out. I was, you know, just thankful when the end of my duty came, and you forget about being stressed out on things like that. You're glad that it comes to an end. So that was a tragedy, a direct hit on one of the vital services. I remember, I think it was the 15th of September 1940. It was a lovely day. I was off duty, and the sun was shining, and looking up into the sky in the back garden, I saw a lot of activity, vapor trails and so on, of aircraft very high up. And then I realized that many of them were German bombers, a formation of German bombers. And so I gathered my wife and with a new baby daughter, and we went and sheltered under the staircase. This was a maisonette, and we were in the lower flat, so the staircase was underneath the... it was secure as we could find. And we heard the bombs coming down then, and I realized that one had hit very close. In fact, two or three had hit very close, and but nothing hit me, although the flat bounced about and shook about, and I know eventually I found that all my china and glass that I'd been given as wedding present was broken. Now, when I went outside, I saw that one of the block of flats, of four buildings diagonally opposite us, had been demolished. I don't know whether I can't remember whether anyone was killed. One was thinking oneself in those days and not very much of other people. Another one that fell a few doors away, it was in the garden of a flat owned by Stan Bryant and his wife. And this bomb had gone down beside their garden shelter, their air raid shelter in the garden, lifted it up into the air, and it had landed down again in the bomb hole, in the cavity that the bomb had made. And they were very worried because they'd recently, or just that previous week, won a prize in Littlewood's football pools. I don't know whether football went on in those days, but obviously it did. They won this football pool prize, and the check was in her handbag. And within the next two or three days, they got shovels and they shifted every ounce of earth around that bomb crater until they eventually found her handbag. And they were able to cash it and rejoice that the bomb had not damaged the handbag, let alone them. The rest of the bombs fell across our estate and demolished houses at the end of Robin Hood Lane, and a bus was blown up into a tree. I think the bus had became, during the raid, the bus had been parked and the occupants had been taken to shelter somewhere, but the bus was actually blown up and caught up in one of the big trees close by, and the rest of the bombs fell into Richmond Park. But that was a very lucky escape that I had, and many other occasions that we've heard bombs going like that, you know, close by, and you'd wonder who was the lucky or who was the unlucky one. And but it was strange that you could almost estimate where the bomb was falling. You heard the whine and you could say, oh, that's a close one, or that's a distant one, that's too far away to worry us. And you became very expert in assessing where a bomb was going to fall. I must remember that during this time, this quiet period of the war, the early quiet period of war before the bombing occurred in seriousness, I was ill with tonsillitis, very bad tonsillitis, and I went to St. Thomas's Hospital and had my tonsils removed. And just so that my wife could get a bit of respite, they sent me down to the Hove police nursing home. And my wife, while I was away there, was able to go up to her parents and her mother in Edinburgh to get a little respite. But when I came back from the Hove after, I think it was 10 days, she returned and we took up occupation in our house again. But I remember an occasion when I was down at Hove, I walked along the front through Brighton, and I was just along, I think, beyond Rodine Girls' School. I was sitting on a bench, looking over the cliffs or the sloping ground along Rodine, by Rodine, and I saw a little, it was misty, and I saw a herd, first of all, and then saw a little light aircraft coming in from the sea, and it flew directly over me, and I saw that it had got German markings. It was a little German training plane, and it landed, it obviously landed or crashed on the golf course just adjacent to Rodine School. Now, in the years since, I've never troubled to find out whether what happened to that little aircraft or what the story was. But I know that in front of me, on the cliffs or on the slope in front of me, there was an machine gun enclosure with soldiers sitting with at their machine gun, but they obviously couldn't have been alert to this aircraft coming in out of the mist and flying over them, because not a shot was fired at them. One of my tours of duty on the wireless car, I had Charlie Martin as my wireless operator. He was an old naval. He'd been in the Navy as a Sparks, or at least a wireless operator. One of the few people in the service that could take and write and read Morse code. And he was, one of the things that he had was a long extension in the car, so that if we got invited for a cup of tea anywhere, we could get out of the car and take the lead across into the front garden or someone's house or a shop and have a cup of tea while he was still on the air. But one of the interesting things when he was my wireless operator was when I went on duty at Putney at 7 o'clock in the morning and found that I'd forgotten my lunch break sandwiches. So I said to Charlie, "Do you mind if we go back home and pick up my sandwiches?" Which was still on the subdivision. It was at Vale Crescent, which was just on the edge of my Putney division. Anyway, we drove down home, and he sat in the car outside while I went in and gathered my sandwiches. When I got out, he said, "Len, something very peculiar is happening." He said, "I've got some Morse signals coming over here." He said, "I can't make them out. They're in groups of five, and no one that I know, and none of our stations send in groups of five. They're all in groups of four." So he continued taking these down, and he said, "Well," he said, "someone must be broadcasting quite close by to here, because as we moved away, the message disappeared. We came back again and we got it." So he obviously realised the significance of this, so we phoned up Scotland Yard, and we got instructions to book off the air and go straight up to Scotland Yard to Special Branch. He took his message page up to Special Branch, and they gave us strict instructions not to talk to anyone about this, not to say anything, but they would inform us in due course of what the outcome of it was. But they asked me if I could sort out who or where the message could have come from, as it was close to my home. And by then I knew practically everyone in Vale Crescent, and everyone, and the only family that I had suspicion of was a German Jewish family living opposite, where there was an old German an old Jewish doctor, and he had his daughter and the daughter's son living there, and what we thought they were refugees, Jewish refugees, so we paid no heed to them. But we found that the lady living in the apartment below told us afterwards that she'd heard typewriting in the early hours of the morning and evening, and she wondered why this man should be typing at that time of the day. So we left the scene and did what we were told, said nothing to anyone, but were very, very curious. And so quite a while afterwards, we made some more inquiries, and they said, thanks to our observation and information, they had discovered a nest of spies in a bungalow at Bracklesham Bay with a wireless up the chimney, sending messages to submarines in the channel. So the thing that puzzled me is why that family were allowed to go on living there until the end of the war. But apparently it's a principle, or one of the principles, that you let your source of information, if it isn't discovered, continue on so that you can watch it. So what else they discovered from this poor man? But if he was a Jew, I feel that he must have been under duress with family back in Germany, possibly threatened with their life if he didn't do this task. But anyway, I feel that that was before the war, before I got into the war proper as in the Air Force. I thought, well, that's one little achievement that we've made to try and beat the enemy, as it were. I mentioned that I had been involved in very close proximity to a fall of incendiary bombs. I found one that hadn't exploded, and I retrieved it, and when I knew that it couldn't have a delayed action on, at least we thought that they couldn't have delayed actions on, I retrieved it and took it back to the garage at Putney. And there was a chemist shop opposite the section house or the police station, and the chemist in there was very keen to know the contents of these bombs, these incendiary bombs. And so I showed him this one, and he said, would it be possible to get the explosive head off, which was a section at the front of the bomb about an inch deep in which the fuse was. So I took it back into the garage, and in the big vise there, and I unscrewed the explosive cap of this incendiary bomb, as much to find out why it hadn't gone off as anything else. But I could see a lot of yellow powder in the nose, and I thought, well, I'll take some of that across to the chemist to see if he can sort out what it was. And I got a penknife, and I started to scrape at this yellow powder, when lo and behold, the whole lot went flash in front of my face, and I found a numbed hand and a bit of a damaged thumb, and nothing left to take to the chemist opposite. And poor man, whether I took it to him or not, it wouldn't have mattered, because in a subsequent bombing, the whole of the row of shops where his shop was demolished, and he was killed alongside with everyone else in it. So that little incident of trying to experiment myself or opening up a bomb myself taught me a lesson, never to touch with things you don't know anything about. And it was, I suppose, shortly after that that things became quiet enough for the Air Force to ask the commissioner if we could spare any of our men to help with the heavy casualties that occurred in aircrew duty in the Air Force with the daily bombings over Berlin and so on, when they were losing half of the fleet that went out each night. And I think it was on the 13th of March 1941 that the police officer issued an order in police orders stating that men under the age of 31 or 28 in the case of the Fleet Air Arm could volunteer as pilots or navigators with the RAF on condition that if they weren't accepted they must return to police duties. And after my experiences of what I'd been through in those first few months and years of the Air Force, in the police force, I thought, well, let's have a go at the Air Force, see if I can get in. It must be safer up there than down here, whatever I do. And I did volunteer. My wife agreed with me that it was something that she was pleased with, because all the time I was serving as a policeman at Putney, she refused to leave me, although she had parents in Edinburgh and relatives in Cheshire. She could have gone away, but she refused to leave me when I was coming home exhausted each day after episodes such as I've recounted. But it wasn't for quite a while. I mean, I carried on serving before my application was accepted, and it was several months later that I was called up into the RAF.
How many other officers, how keen were other officers to take an opportunity to join the services?
Well, there were. I mean, between the whole of the Metropolitan Police, between that 13th of March and the end of that year, 600 officers had been accepted, had volunteered and been accepted. Many more had volunteered, but 600 had been accepted for the Air Force. And many years later, when I thought back on it and wondered how many survived, I checked records and I found that of those 600, 200 had been killed in that first year. And so I sort of went about trying to do something about it, and eventually, as I shall say later on, I did arrange a reunion of these sort of people.
Now, how big a factor was the fact that you'd lived through the Blitz, and not so much the fact that you could have, you know, you had a better survival chance in the Air Force, but that's obviously proved to be wrong. Was there a sense of getting back at the Germans?
Yes, I think there was. When you're on the ground receiving bombs falling on you, you feel impotent. There's nothing you can do about it. We know we had AK-AK guns firing up at them, but we know that now that they were more than useless. So you were there sitting ducks waiting to be have your bombs dropped on you, and you feel anything to do to get back at them, you would have done so. And that's why there was such a response of people wanting to join the Air Force. And although few of them, it was only a limited number that were allowed to join or had the age range or the physical ability to qualify, which I'm thankful that I did have those abilities and qualifications.
Do you remember how many people serving officers at Putney went?
I suppose there must have been half a dozen, not more than that. There were about half a dozen that applied. Putney Section House, of course, we had some of the Walham Green people living in there. So, yes, the Section House, I think I had about six people, all told, qualified and got accepted from the Section House.
And what was the views of your senior officers to losing valuable men such as yourself?
I don't really know, and I think there was a certain amount of resentment because they thought that we were missing, you know, ducking the bombing to join the Air Force. But and I know that was true when we got back. The people who had survived and got back into the Air Force from the Air Force and rejoined the police force when we were released, we were not accepted. We were not treated with any extra pride or anything like that in our achievements. We were looked upon as people who'd tried to miss the bombing, and many of the people we never thought about it. I don't think when I rejoined the force I told a single person about any of my exploits in the Air Force. They weren't really interested, and so I just kept quiet about it.
Now, between volunteering and actually being accepted, you must have gone through some sort of selection procedure for the Air Force. What did that entail?
Yes, it did. I went up to a Dastrell House and was interviewed there and given certain tests, mostly mathematical tests. And I remember one of the little problems they asked me, did I know what Pythagoras was? And I was able to solve Pythagoras' problem for me and for them, and they didn't believe that I hadn't been prompted or had cheated. They thought a policeman surely was not qualified to know Pythagoras, and I went back in the interview room and I repeated Pythagoras' theorem and how to solve it, and they more or less laughed and said, well, we didn't expect that as the outcome of this. We thought you must have been primed or someone must have told you about it. At any rate, I was accepted as a pilot. And although some of my colleagues had to be accepted as navigators. So navigators and pilots were both accepted in from the police force.